You're listening to the Overdrive Podcast, Hour 1.
Welcome aboard for Friday, Overdrive, TSN 1050, also streaming on the TSN app and on TSN 4 on the television side. Jim Taddy subbing for Gord Miller, who was subbing for Brian Hayes, and actually David Naylor's in there too. Josh Leuenberger's in here subbing for just about anybody in the building. Josh,
list them alphabetical order, Taddy.
There's a lot of them. So we are. I mean, it's getaway day. Literally, did you know this? That 172,000 people will be pushed through Pearson International Airport today. This is the ultimate getaway day of the summer.
I did not know that, but I'm happy I do now.
Yeah. Why
today?
I guess because 2 weeks till Labor Day weekend. This is the last sort of summer getaway if you're flying somewhere and have to be back.
And you're just getting back.
I just got back from London, England, and had a great time. What have you done this summer? I mean, you actually had a couple of weeks off, didn't you?
Yeah, no, I was excited to sleep. I've slept, and that was the big thing after a busy run, a championship run that extended the summer to June. Basically, I'm used to being off by early May, mid May. This year it was a lot different. So by that first month, I was just happy to do nothing. I really enjoy. I enjoy doing nothing more than the average person. I think
I may give you a run for that.
Really?
Yeah, I don't mind doing zip all.
Doing nothing is underrated. I don't get bored easy. So, I've been doing that. I've been sleeping, going up north a little bit. I'm going to Prince Edward County this weekend. I'm looking forward to that. That'll be good. But nothing too exciting. No big travel trips or anything like that.
So one of my, one of my sort of operating agendas every year, and I do it different ways. When I have a chunk of time off, I like to delete all the reference points. This year I had to leave the country to do that, but I did delete the file. So I can remember next to nothing. You're going to have to help me out with that. And I just start piling in new reference points, starting with today and moving forward, getting set for, of course, the Leafs and Raptors seasons, the football in the CFL to gear up, and, of course, the NFL to start in the MLB playoffs. I mean, there's a lot of stuff there.
It's a weird time of year.
Yeah, a lot of anticipation. So
yeah.
A couple of the things we're going to follow today. BMW Championship on the PGA Tour. Hideki Matsuyama finished with a 9-under today. 12-under has the lead. Patrick Cantlay is next at 10-under. Adam Hadwin was 4-under in the day and is tied with a group of players at 9-under. So Bob Weeks will be by at the bottom of the hour to go over that. And I know what you're saying. What did Tiger do? So I have to. He's under Corey Connors, who is 3-under through 10, minus 6 for the tournament. And where is Tiger? He's down there somewhere. Boy, I guess it wasn't too good for Tiger. There he is, minus 2, minus 1 on the day, so back-to-back 71s. And the way I look at Tiger, I don't know how you approach this or how much you care about it, but people are sort of looking for the definitive moment when it's over or when it comes back to the way it was.
And neither have happened.
And I don't think either one will happen.
Yeah.
It's sort of going to be a gradual fade. So he won the Masters this year and hasn't done much since. Which doesn't bother me. I mean, if he won a major every year or every second year for the next 3 or 4 years, that would be good enough, wouldn't it?
You would think. I think most people are just looking for that moment where you know which direction he's headed. And it's been years, right? Since
well, nobody will ever do that again.
No,
that's domination. That's resetting, actually creating an economic currency that wasn't there before. Taking it to a level it was never supposed to be at. I mean, that's a complete one-off. The other things we're going to follow is the Raptors. The Argos at home to Edmonton tonight at BMO Field. 7 o'clock, our coverage starts here on TSN 1050 with Mike Hogan. Jays at home to the Mariners. So let's sort of move into the Jays story, which, you know, we talked a bit about it off-air, getting set for the show. And there are some parallels between the Raptors and Jays, albeit the Raptors getting it done, but the Jays had that moment a couple of years ago where it looked like it could happen. And so, you know, I'm not going to get into, we could sort of explore what the Jays did at the trade deadline, but I mean, clearly when you look back on it, I mean, what was the difference between AA rolling the dice for the Jays and it almost working, and Masai Ujiri rolling the dice and it worked? I mean, this is what you want, right?
Watching baseball last night, you had Josh Donaldson hitting a home run off of Stroman. He ended up hitting two home runs in a game that Stroman gets the win in. And it was another one of those nights where you are thinking, okay, well, what did they get for those guys again? But it is interesting how much the narrative has changed over these last couple weeks since the now infamous trade deadline that you mentioned, which was really such a PR disaster. But the narrative has changed a little bit with the kids coming up, Bo Bichette coming up. Vlad's been hitting the ball really well, and I mean, Atkins and Shapiro should be taking these guys out for dinner because they're really taking the heat off of what many believe to be an inept front office. All of a sudden, rather than dwelling on the past and the deadline and what they got or what they didn't get, it's about the future and how good these kids look. And that was sort of the idea, I think. That was the hope, obviously, when they brought Bichette up at a time in which, as I mentioned, it was just such a PR disaster following the Stroman trade and the Sanchez trade. But what shouldn't be lost in all of this, of course, is there was no guarantees that even a high-level prospect like Bichette would come up and start hitting. The fact that it's worked out as well or better than they could have hoped is icing on the cake, because a lot of the times, as we saw with Vlad earlier this year, a high-level prospect will come up, struggle a little bit. Mike Trout, one of the best, will go down as one of the best hitters of all time, had to be sent back down because he struggled. So things have changed here, but at the same time, the big picture is still the same, right? They didn't get a whole lot out of those trades at the deadline. That hasn't changed. The pitching cupboard is still relatively empty. That hasn't changed. And the front office is one that doesn't inspire a whole lot of confidence. That hasn't changed. But I think what we're seeing now, for the first time really all year, the Jays have been fun to watch over the last couple weeks, and there is legitimate cause for optimism when you look at the kids and you look at some of these guys that could be and should be around for many years.
Yeah, the way I look at it is, so what works in the marketplace? And clearly the roll of the dice works. And really the attention span of most sports fans these days is a lot shorter than it would have been years ago, where you would buy into the build. I mean, even the Maple Leaf build is really fast-tracked, and it has to happen sooner rather than later, as opposed to a 10-year plan. And the baseball build can take much more than 10 years. But I think because of the frustration in the marketplace, added to the success of the Raptors, where you could roll the dice and win, that there's sort of this demand. I mean, that's the world we live in, the video game world, the social media world, where things spin around rather fast as opposed to that slow, methodical approach. I mean, that's what people want here, right?
I have mixed feelings on that. I hear what you're saying, Taddy, but I do think people are more, fans are more accepting of the idea of a rebuild or a tank in every sport now, maybe than ever before, because there's a better understanding with analytics and the building of teams and how these things are usually done, that the teams that go from a window of opportunity to the next window of opportunity are rare. Those are the exceptions. Normally, you have to build, and you have to start from the bottom. So people get it. I agree with you. I think the ones that take longer are the ones that that alienate more people. And then also, and this goes back to the front office and what the conversation has been like, especially over these last couple weeks since the deadline, I think in order to sell the rebuild, you need to be upfront about it. You need to be honest about it. You need to be authentic with it. And if you're not, people won't have patience for it. And I think it's that corporate spin. It's that, this isn't a likable front office right now.
Well,
and that's the difference. You mentioned Alex Anthopoulos. I think that's the biggest difference, because remember, the Jays were a winning team under Anthopoulos for the final year, 2 years, whatever. But for the most part, I mean, that was a mediocre team. And Anthopoulos, he made a lot of moves. He took a lot of swings. Some worked, some didn't. I think that's sort of lost in the way that we remember Alex Anthopoulos, because he is remembered in a lot of ways as a hero here from a lot of people because of how things ended during his tenure. But I think people forget a lot of those things that didn't go right, not just with Anthopoulos, but you mentioned Masai. It's the same thing with Masai. These are likable guys. These are sincere and relatable guys that come across well in the media and to fans. And I think that goes a long way, and that's what this current Jays front office is missing.
Yeah, I would agree with you. I think there's a disconnect there, but I think if you go back to Double-A and certainly Masai, they seem to connect with the fan base.
Yeah.
They seem to read the fan base. If you go back to the roll of the dice by the Blue Jays, that came out of a winter meeting with season ticket holders, and Paul Beeston in Double-A understood that people wanted things to roll forward and move on and roll the dice. You could sense that out of the marketplace, that people wanted something to happen. And so they made the moves, and you know, it wasn't as successful as the Raptors, but they haven't been in the playoffs since, and that was something to celebrate. not much to celebrate now. I mean, you could celebrate the arrival of the left side of the infield, but as you detailed, the pitching staff, I mean, that's going to take years. You can't mask that in any way, shape, or form. That's a massive rebuild there, and it's going to take years and a bit of luck.
And that's why this issue is bigger than just simply the front office is not especially likable right now, because I do think, I mean, they've done some things right, but they've done a lot of things wrong. This has been a mismanagement of assets to this point, because you had that team that they took over, the team that made the playoffs two straight seasons, and yeah, they were nearing the end of their window, and it wasn't necessarily an ideal or desirable situation to jump into, because in either scenario they were going to end up being the bad guys by tearing down that team. But there were still guys on that team while they were older that had value. Josh Donaldson, I mean, even still to this day, he's had a great year with Atlanta. They sold him at a time in which his value couldn't have possibly been lower. And if they had sold him when they should have, before last season, I mean, there are multiple reports that St. Louis was offering Jack Flaherty, the reigning NL Rookie of the Year and the ace for the Cardinals, and Jordan Hicks, their closer. Those two pitchers would be the best two pitchers in the Jays organization right now. So it comes down, like anything else, to timing and asset management. You don't necessarily have to trade guys when their value is as high as it's ever going to be, but you also don't want to trade them when their value is as low as it's ever going to be. You let Edwin walk out the door, so all of a sudden for that team, Estrada, Happ, all those guys, I mean, you could make a list of it now, and the prospects you have specifically on the pitching side of it don't necessarily match with the success that that team had. You want to get something out of that success, even to transition to whatever the next era is. And Shapiro and Atkins didn't do a good enough job of that. They've got pieces, but to your point, Jim, there's a lot of work to be done, a long ways to go, and it's not like they have that one veteran guy that they can throw out into the market and say, okay, let's replenish our pitching farm system here with this one guy. They've traded pretty much everybody. All they have left is the kids.
Well, and the other, I guess, thing that makes you double or think twice about this would be that when you're talking about pitching prospects, obviously they just traded two away that were supposed to be one and two. Stroman and Sanchez were supposed to lead the way. Well, it didn't happen. As highly rated as they are and were, and as well as they may do in their new locations, the fact is here it didn't work out. So if you're going to trot out the next Stroman and Sanchez, that's not really the answer, is it? You need more than that.
You need a depth for any rebuilding team. As we talk about all the time with these things, especially in baseball, the prospects, drafting, it's not an exact science. Some of these guys will hit, but a lot of them will miss. And it's interesting because I talk about the perception of Atkins and Shapiro and how a lot of it is corporate spin. If they were more authentic, if they, I heard, I don't know where the interview was, but Atkins, I believe it was today. Do we have that clip?
I think we do. Oh, the MLB Network Radio. Can we play it? Let's listen to this. Ross Atkins, as he spoke, sort of justifying, it was yesterday, okay, as he spoke justifying what they did at the trade deadline.
The hard part for fans is that we have so much information on the players that we acquired, and Anthony Kay and Simeon Woods Richardson and Derek Fisher, and the fans don't have as much information. So it's harder to wrap their arms around, okay, we just traded away players that we love and know and have cheered for some time, and we have no idea what's behind it and what's coming. That doesn't make it easy for us. They're always difficult. It's always very painful to be selling. It's never fun. There's nothing romantic about that, and
right.
It's always a difficult situation, but what we have the confidence in is the process and the work that got done to acquire the talent that we feel lines up very well with our position player core.
So, not sure I would have gone down the fan base road.
There are things about that I really like and things about that I really don't like. So, first of all, what I liked is if he had come out and said that directly after the trade, polishing it up a little bit.
Well, just delete the reference to the fan base.
The fans, yeah. This is what the fans don't understand. Maybe get rid of that, and his PR person should be telling him that. Maybe don't throw the fans under the bus there.
Zero in on the media if you want, but not the fan base.
But the message there was interesting, because I think that that's somewhat authentic, is that, listen, drafting, prospects, all that stuff is an inexact science in baseball. Every year, there are high-ranking prospects that miss, and lower-ranking prospects that hit and come out of seemingly nowhere because, of course, these teams know more than we do. They have more information, as he said and probably shouldn't have said, pointing to the fans, is that they have their evaluation process. They have their scouting department. And all he had to say initially was, listen, we feel that these prospects are undervalued and underrated, that we've targeted these guys because we feel they are better than what a lot of people believe they are going to end up being, and that's why we made the trades. That's it. That's all that had to be said. I think all of the corporate spin of the 42 years of control and all of that, I mean, that's what set people off. And now, of course, with the here's what fans don't understand, that's why I say with a little bit more polish and just being more relatable and authentic, the message isn't that bad. And ultimately, as you said earlier, Jim, is like in any situation where there's a rebuild or a tank and things aren't going well, it's tough to come out of that and look good. Maybe in hindsight, if in 2-3 years from now the Jays are a winning team, people look back and okay, those guys weren't so bad after all. But in the moment, it's tough to come out looking good. But at the same time, they're making things even harder on themselves by portraying themselves, the team, and their decisions the way that they are.
Having said that, I mean, if Masai Ujiri got up there and said anything, first of all, he wouldn't go to the fan base, but you would believe that even if you didn't buy into the wording he was using, you would believe that he would do the right thing because he has.
He inspires trust and confidence. A lot of that is because he's done it, and the sample size is big enough now. We've seen it, and he's been successful through it. But I also think, like I said, there's another element of it, and it's the way that you speak and the way that you project. And, I mean, just listening to Masai speak,
yeah,
even from day one, even before he had the success here, his very first press conference when he said, and I quote, "We will win in Toronto." And ultimately, they ended up winning in Toronto. But even before that, it's the way that he speaks. It's like if the GM thing, if the front office thing doesn't work out for Masai, there's another career in motivational speaking in line for him just because of the way he commands a room and delivers a speech. It's a talent. It's a skill that not everybody has. Obviously, I think Anthopoulos had it in a different way. He's not larger than life in the same way that Masai Ujiri is, but he's relatable in the way that Masai Ujiri is. And I think for those guys, you don't have to be perfect, and you're never going to be perfect as a general manager. For all of the Masai Ujiri successes, I mean, the Bruno Caboclo pick and the Damari Carroll signing and a few things that didn't work, but you forget about those things, and you forget about those things that Alex Anthopoulos didn't do well, those trades that didn't work or the signings that didn't work, the draft picks, because at the end of the day, you like the guy, you trust the guy.
Well, and he gave you something to like or to enjoy.
Yeah.
Well, that's the missing piece with the current Blue Jay front office. They haven't given you anything.
And maybe it'll happen, and it's happening right now in the small sense of these last 2 weeks where they're 11-6 since they called up Bo Bichette. But word of warning is 162 games, it's a long season. The
ultimate sample size.
The good teams are going to go through peaks, and the good teams are going to go through valleys, and the bad teams are going to go through peaks, even during a season. But we've seen now the Jays have pieces. It's not a complete, it's not as gloom and doom the way that it's looked at points throughout the year. But at the same time, like there's a long way to go here. It's not basketball. We make the comparison to Masai, but it's not basketball. You can't have two or three really good players and say, okay, well, here's our team. Especially in baseball, you need pitching. You need a pitching staff. You need other guys down the bottom of the lineup, top of the lineup. And while you've got a foundation here, if you're the Jays, to work around, to work with, to build from, again, you don't have other guys now that you can throw into a trade and say, okay, give us a few of your prospects. They basically clean their organization out of that. And now there's pressure on Atkins and Shapiro to draft well and to make the most out of the assets that they do have. Because you're not going to trade a Vlad and recoup prospects there. That's your prospect.
Well, You may in five years.
You may have to, but you don't want it to come to that.
No.
That's why you've got to maximize the assets you have. And to this point, probably the biggest weakness that this specific Jays front office has had, in addition, obviously, to the PR stuff, is managing their assets.
When we come back, we're going to hear from Bob Weeks from Golf Talk Canada and the golf department here at TSN headquarters, going over the BMW Championships as the Tour Championship goes next week and the golf season is done. And just to recap, it was Matsuyama with the big game today, the 9-under round, and he sits atop the leaderboard with a 63 today at 12 under. Patrick Cantlay, through 17, is 5 under and sits at 11 under. And all that means is that the Canadian Adam Hadwin has slipped down to a T6 now at 9 under. He was 4 under for the day. But we'll sort all that out next with Bob Weeks. You're listening to Overdrive on TSN 1050, watching on TSN 4. That's old music. It has to be. Oh, picked that, didn't he? Welcome back to Overdrive. Jim Taddy and Josh Lundberg subbing for the regulars. It's Getaway Friday, trust me, as 172,000 people will be spirited through the Pearson International Airport today to get away. That's quite a crowd.
Where are they going?
Anywhere, wherever you want. That's worldwide, right? They're just dispersing all over the place. Let's get into just one more thing before we talk golf with Bob Weeks. DeMarcus Cousins tears his ACL. I mean, this is getting ready. This is for the FIBA thing, right?
No, he wasn't going to play for Team USA. So this is what's so interesting, because of course Kelly Olynyk suffers an injury not even close to as serious as this was in the first exhibition game for Team Canada, and of course everyone points to, well, what was he doing at the time? He was playing for his country, and you have all the people talking about and saying, well, that's why you shouldn't play for your country and all of that. DeMarcus Cousins, when he just tore his ACL, he was practicing in Las Vegas, just preparing for the season, and no one's saying he shouldn't practice, because of course that's, he should be practicing. All these guys, like, at some point during the summer, you're not sitting there wrapped in bubble wrap, chilling in bubble wrap. You're out there playing or practicing or whatever. Injuries can happen anywhere at any time, and they're brutal, and they can be brutal. The Cousins injury is an example of it, and specifically for him, I mean, that sucks. This is a guy that is still in his prime, or would have been in his prime, but has been robbed of it because of injuries. The Achilles, the quad, and now the ACL. I think it's pretty safe to say that we've seen the last of DeMarcus Cousins at an all-star or at a superstar level. He was once the best big man in the game, but his NBA career is now in jeopardy. That's to go through those three serious injuries in a span of 2 years. That's tough, and that's brutal. And he's been a fascinating case from the get-go, of course, spending all that time with the Kings, missing the playoffs, a polarizing personality and player to begin with. And now I think we look back at his career in whatever amount of years and say, well, what if? Because for all of the criticism of Cousins on and off the court, he's a guy that had a ton of talent, a player really unique in the NBA. We haven't seen a guy like that, that had that kind of power and strength, but also the versatility, the finesse, the ability to do so many things. He was dominant, and we might never see him at that level again. We probably won't.
You know, as you were going through that, I thought of two things that I've witnessed, one in person and one just by watching the game on television, that you would watch them and go, seriously, like, you couldn't see that happening. When KD came back, what game was that against the Raptors? Is it game 5?
Yes.
And so you're watching him and you go, oh, this guy's really, really good. And then you watch them play him, and then he goes down, innocent play, and he's out, and you go, did they just do that? Why would they do that? And the other one was Lindros years ago against the Devils, and, you know, he's playing, and you realize that Scott Stevens at some point in the game was going to tag him, and he did, and it wasn't pleasant to watch. But these are two really great athletes having their careers basically altered by I would say improper management of their career. That's what I would say.
It's unfortunate, and I think in the case of Cousins as well, I mean, that's a big dude. That's a big guy that's playing at a speed that you don't really normally see guys of his size play at. And that's why you're worried, and a lot of people are worried for Zion, because he's a guy also really big, really mobile. There is some concern about how sustainable, how durable guys like that will be. And I think Cousins, well, yeah, I mean, these things can happen to anybody at any time. I think Cousins is an example of it. It's tough for a big guy. It's one thing if you're Shaq and you're parked down low and it's feed me the ball sort of thing and you're just posting up. But for those guys to be getting up and down and jumping at the height and the velocity that they're the high flyers, I mean, there's a risk there.
We're going to deal with golf shortly. Bob Weeks will be with us. Leo Roten's at 5 o'clock, 5:05, basically talking about FIBA and the Raptors and a bunch of basketball stuff. Yes Guy, No Guy at 5:30. At 6:05, Keegan Matheson talking baseball. At 6:25, Jabari Greer. And we have best bets along the way. Next segment, we have the Sound Wars. So we'll get all that stuff in that is in the normal position on overdrive, as you would expect it. Just before we bring in Bob Weeks, Vince Carter is just not going to fade away. And this is, I'm intrigued with this story because what you learn over the years, and certainly over the last 5 years, is the man's love for the game, which you would never have guessed as he played as a Raptor. There was another persona there, another judgment on him that just doesn't apply anymore.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's no questioning the guy's love for the game, playing 22 seasons, well into his 40s now. He could have called it quits years ago and no one would have batted an eye or questioned him. He clearly loves to play, but at the same time, I think it's fair to question his competitive spirit, signing with teams like Atlanta, Sacramento, playing out the latter stages of his career on bad teams rather than playing for a winner, chasing a championship. And I know that people criticize the ring chasers as well, but I just find him, I mean, Vince Carter has always been really interesting. Not everybody, as we know, not every competitor, not every player, not every athlete is wired the same way. I don't think he doesn't have the same killer instinct that Kobe Bryant does. Kobe, for example, could never have extended his career and played coming off the bench a few minutes a game like Vince is. I just don't think he's wired that way. Allen Iverson, same thing. That's why his career was cut a little bit short, just because he wouldn't make that transition. At Carmelo Anthony, he's a guy that's been criticized because he doesn't seem willing to do essentially what Vince has done. So I don't think it's not like a black and white thing where you can say this is the right way to do it, this is the wrong way to do it. I just think it's really interesting because you see these guys are wired differently. And in the case of Vince, it's just, I mean, for him to continue playing yet not trying to win a championship, I think is interesting.
Or maybe it speaks to him setting himself up for the rest of his life. I mean, if we go with that he loves the game, he's going to want to continue on, whether it's coaching.
Well, it seems like broadcasting is what's next for Vince.
So that's sort of what he's trying to do, isn't it, to find the right spot?
And in Atlanta, I mean, the proximity to TNT, to Turner, that's one of the theories as to why he's landed there over the last couple of years, is it allows him to get his feet wet a little bit, get some broadcasting experience, and he has had some experience even working the playoffs last year. He's going to be highly coveted as a broadcaster when he does call it a career, which we now assume will be at the end of this season. But as we joked about off air, Taddy, it's like it seems like every year it's Vince Carter's last game in Toronto. There's been like 10 Vince Carter last games in Toronto.
Take 10.
Yeah,
it's like that story runs parallel to the biggest game in Raptors franchise history, as we had about 10 of those this year, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's good for narrative purposes, right?
It is. So the BMW Championship grinding on today's round, which would be round two, because it is Friday. I'm losing track of time here. Matsuyama with a 12-under, 9-under today, 63 on the day, 12-under leads, but just by one stroke over Cantley, who has now done 5-under today, sits at 11-under. A couple of Tony Finau and Kistner at 10-under, and Hadwin is now in a T5 at 9-under with a cluster of players. Bob Weeks from Golf Talk Canada is here. Bob, how are you today, sir?
Doing very well, Jim. How are you?
Very good, thanks. 63, that redefines sizzling, doesn't it?
It does, and for a guy who kind of had a slow start to the year but has been heating up a lot lately, Hideki Matsuyama, it's great. And again, you know, this is the time of year when we're all sort of looking at not only who's leading the tournament but where they are positioned in terms of getting onto the next level. This is the second of three playoff events, and the top 30 for here will go on to the FedEx Cup final.
Okay, let's talk about the Canadians, specifically Adam Hadwin to start off. He was 4-under today, 9-under for the tournament, so 67 and 68. We have consistency anyway, don't we?
Yeah, Adam's actually playing pretty solid lately coming into this tournament. He's had a couple of good finishes. His putter, which is the club that really kind of got him onto the tour and got him that first win, got him that 59, but kind of left in the last year and a half or so, is finally starting to return. His putting stats have been very good over the last couple of starts. And he's got himself into position. He needs a pretty good finish, though, to move on to next week. Right now, even though he's tied for fifth this week in the tournament, he's only projected to finish 33rd, and that wouldn't get him into the next week to the Tour Championship. So he's got to have two more good rounds on the weekend if he hopes to play again next week.
So take us through the way that final tournament is set up and who's sort of negotiable in terms of the cut line to move forward to next week.
Yeah, right now, the actual bubble boy is the other Canadian in the field. It's Corey Connors, who was at 31st. In fact, now, just as I speak, he's made a birdie, and he's gone to 28. So you can see how things can fluctuate very quickly. But the basics of what's going on is next week there'll be two events being played at the same time. There'll be the Tour Championship, which is the season finale, but there's also the FedEx Cup, the overall season points, the winner of which will get $15 million. So there's a big payday for somebody coming. And the way they're going to do it this year is they don't want to try and have those two events running at the same time. So they've staggered the field in essence. So whoever is number one in the FedEx Cup rankings at the end of the week, at the end of this tournament, will start at 10 under par. Second place guy will be at 8 under par. It's kind of like the member guest, you know, everyone's getting shots here and there. But they're going to end up with one guy who will win both the Tour Championship and the FedEx Cup next week.
Bob, of course, I have to ask for the Tiger update. How's he looked so far?
Tiger actually played pretty well. He looked good in terms of, I guess there's two ways to gauge it. One is to look at how he is physically, and he looks fine. He doesn't look like he's wincing or ailing or kind of hurting. The other side is his game, and it looks rusty. So, you know, he stumbled in a little bit. He was pretty good. He bogeyed 16 and 17, however, finished at one under par. He's back at tied for 46 right now. Right now, he's going to have to put together a magical weekend and have any chance of playing next week, defending his title at the Tour Championship. I would suspect this will probably be the last tournament you'll see for Tiger Woods this year, barring he's got a couple of commitments that he's going to play in the fall in Japan. But right now, what he looks like is he looks rusty. He looks like a guy who hasn't been able to practice, hasn't been able to play. This is just his 16th competitive round since he won the Masters back in April. So you can see he hasn't got a large work behind him this year, judging his stroke. I guess you could say, Josh, in your terms, it's kind of load management. He's trying to guard against hurting himself. You can make sense of that one.
Yeah, now I can understand.
You know, and he's been practicing this for a number of years. I mean, the way the season ended last year with him and the way it started with the Masters, it sort of led you one way, and the reality was it took a fork in the road, didn't it?
Yeah, I think a lot of us kind of got, you know, understandably got persuaded by what he did at the Tour Championship, what he did in the last two majors last year, and on the course winning the Masters this year. But I think what we forget is he's still kind of a patched up, bolted together golfer. He's had four operations on his back. He's had four on his knee. So, you know, he's going to have good days and he's going to have bad days. He's going to have good weeks and bad weeks where he's going to be able to play and not. And I think, honestly, in my heart, if you know, Tiger winning the Masters at the end of that, I think anything else he could accomplish after that was going to be gravy. And I think that may be what he felt a little bit too. I mean, he's certainly hyper-competitive, but winning the Masters kind of put him back into a place where, yeah, he did prove that he could do it again. He may do it again next year, but I think for the rest of the season, really, it was a bit of a disappointment for Tiger.
In terms of the leaderboard, I'm looking at it here. Tommy Fleetwood was 6-under today. Kevin Kisner was 6-under today. Who do you see charging up on the weekend?
You know, the guy who's caught my eye is Xander Schauffele, who's still out on the golf course right now. He's at 9-under par. He's 4-under through his first 11. He's a guy who's played sort of a sneaky, really good year so far this season. And he won twice, but he won very early in the season. He won once in the fall portion of last year and then at the Tournament of Champions at the start of this year. So, but he's had a pretty decent year, and he's a guy I think who could do some damage. He's won before in 2017, the FedEx Cup Final, the Tour Championship at Eastlake. So if he gets back there, if he can manage to get back there, which looks like he will, he might have a good chance of pulling this whole thing off.
Going back to the format and the Tour Championship, what could happen over the next 2 days that could take a lot of the mystery out of what happens next week?
Well, if Brooks Koepka was ever to get himself in a position to win this week, then I think, you know, he would be sort of the odds-on favorite. There's still nobody going to be more than two shots ahead, which sounds strange, but going into the final. But I think if Brooks Koepka wins this week, he's going to show that he's the dominant player. He's had such a dominant year this year that it's really hard to kind of bet against him. But, you know, he's still a little ways back in the pack. Rory McIlroy back there as well, another guy who I think could sort of make a big charge up the leaderboard. But if you're in the top five or so going into next week, you know, you really, I won't say you control your own destiny, but you have a lot better chance than the guy who's sitting 28th, 29th, or 30th of making a big push.
Okay, almost at the end of the season, so you have the reality of what really did happen. How does that compare with what you thought was going to happen?
I never saw Brooks Koepka winning again, I think, in another major. I thought that was an interesting part. I never thought Tiger would win another major. That may be the most surprising part. I thought it was a good year when you, overall for Canadian golf. If you look at all the guys who were on there, we had, I think, 9 Canadians who were eligible to play on the PGA Tour. Now, some of them have lost their privileges. Ben Silverman is one of them, and a couple other guys who've gone down and now are playing in the Corn Ferry, formerly Web.com Tour playoffs. I think he had a great breakout year from Corey Connors, and I think you're going to see more from him. He got the win at the Texas Open. And then Adam Hadwin's having another solid season. So, you know, for the Canadians, it was a pretty good season overall. I guess if you were actually asking me about the overall performance of Canadians, the best one would be Brooke Henderson, who's going to be playing next week at the CP Women's Open just up the road in Aurora. I mean, 2 victories so far, and she's still got a few more to play.
And, you know, what she's done this year, does that alter? I mean, she was on a really good trajectory anyway in terms of her career, but have you altered it in a positive fashion at all?
Yeah, I mean, I'm just stunned by how good she is and how young she is. She's 21 years old. She's won more at that level than any other Canadian golfer, male or female. She's played just under 4 years and just about to cross $6 million in earnings, which on the women's tour is amazing. I think she's played 120 tournaments on the LPGA Tour now. 43 of those have been top 10 finishes. That's a staggering mark for her. And I think she's still hungry. She still wants to play more golf. She just loves to go out, hit the ball, and go and find it, hit it again. So, you know, there could be a lot more coming for Brooke Henderson.
Bob, thanks very much. Enjoy your weekend.
Take care, guys.
That's Bob Weeks, TSN golf analyst, host of Golf Talk Canada with Mark Sacchino. When we come back, we'll do Sound Wars. You're listening to Overdrive on TSN 1050, watching on TSN 4.
This is TSN 1050's Sound Wars.
They did it, Taylor!
All right, here we go. Today's edition of Sound Wars, the OMG Bracket, Round 2, Seed 2 against Seed 6. We start off with Kawhi's shot, second round, Game 7, Raptors against Sixers, and you know the rest.
They get it to Leonard, drives right, down to the baseline, fall away for the win! Got it! And danced on the rim! It hit 4 rims and went down! Toronto wins! My goodness.
Oh, yeah. You remember that?
Yeah, I think I recall. Jonesy's voice reached a level there I didn't even know. That was like another octane that I didn't even realize it could reach.
And the pause between him understanding it went in really summed up how it was in that building that night.
That was incredible. Is this matchup planned for the show that I was hosting?
I don't know. I think so, because seed number 6 is Kawhi dunks on Giannis, Game 6 of the conference finals. Following a steal by Lowry, Kawhi puts the icing on the cake.
Middleton drives, cut off, stolen by Lowry. On the run, Lowry to Leonard, down to down! He threw it in the face of Giannis Antetokounmpo! Kawhi Leonard with punctuation! Oh, baby, what a play by Kawhi!
Jonesy needing the larynx transplant after the game. Those were exciting plays, and I think both of them typify the Kawhi Leonard chapter with the Raptors.
Is this the Kawhi bracket or the Jonesy bracket?
Well, we'll find out. It's up to you now to vote on your favorite. Go to tsn1050.ca, decide which clip is moving on.
It's got to be the Kawhi shot, right?
Oh, absolutely. That's
a walk-off. We'd never seen anything like that before.
No, it's been a while, right? Touch 'em all, Joe and Kawhi with the 4 bounces. I'll never forget that because we were up so high, you know, where Dwayne and I were sitting in the hockey press box, that you could only tell it went in when you saw the net sort of ripple.
After the shot, after that game, a bunch of my friends and I, we had a debate. What was the bigger Toronto sports moment? The Jose Bautista bat flip or the Kawhi shot? And now in hindsight, obviously looking at the fact that the Raptors won the championship, and had that shot not gone in, maybe they lose in overtime and maybe they get bounced in the second round. Obviously the shot looks pretty good now, but at the time, I mean, it was a really interesting debate. There are people that swear by the bat flip as just this incredible moment, and it was
dramatic.
It was, but at the same time, that was, I believe it was in the seventh inning.
Yes.
So it wasn't quite, well, didn't have quite the same impact as a walk-off, as a shot that wins the game. And yeah, the Raptors could have ended up going on to win in overtime. But there were serious dramatics in that moment. There was a serious chance, there was a legitimate chance that that could be the end of the Raptors' season.
Well, it could have been. And I think because we know the rest of the story now, you would look back on that. That was the first sign of what was to come.
Obviously a big Toronto moment, but even in the grand scheme of things, an NBA moment, a basketball moment, that was something, a walk-off in the playoffs like that, that had never happened before. It was history, and that's one of the things. I mean, I talked to Isaiah Thomas, not the current point guard Isaiah Thomas, the Hall of Famer Isaiah Thomas.
The former Raptors employee.
Yes, after one of the games in the finals here in Toronto, and asked him about that shot and what it meant and how big it could be just in terms of the basketball context. And he compared it to the Michael Jordan shot over Craig Elo, just in terms of something that we'll be seeing for years, sure. Forever. Kids, I mean, certainly in Toronto will grow up and they're going to be on their driveway and or in the park and taking that shot, falling away on the baseline and then crouching down as Kawhi did. You'll have guys pretending to be Jordan Lloyd standing next to it. I mean, that was a moment, yeah, that we'll never forget. Obviously, in hindsight, because of the championship, it adds to it. But I think even in that moment, we had a pretty good idea of how special that was.
It's the kind of moment could turn up on a stamp at some point.
Absolutely. Maybe on the loony.
Yes, that would be nice. So, if you're tuning in and going, who are these two mugs? Jim Taddy and Josh Lewenberg, subbing for the regulars. Behind the glass, the regulars are there. The grappler is there. Moles is there. The grappler's already made a mess of things, and that happens from time to time. We'll get him on later on in the broadcast. Coming up shortly, top of the hour, it'll be Leo Routens talking about basketball, FIBA, in the Raptors. Yes Guy, No Guy returns, this time sanctioned at 5:30, which is always a bit of an issue here, but we'll leave that one alone. And we have just a couple of seconds before we break for the top of the hour. But the FIBA's, where are you on all this big game today?
Yeah, I mean, Canada pulling off an upset win in Australia early this morning. Where were you at 5:30 a.m.?
Not awake.
Well, Team Canada, or what's left of them after all the NBAers withdrew, what's left of them beat Australia, a really good team with five NBA players, by 20 points, and they'll have the rematch again tomorrow morning.
Okay, we'll pause there and pick it up on the other side. You're listening to Overdrive on TSN 1050, watching on TSN 4.